With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Mr. Beacon Podcast is sponsored by Wiliot, scaling IoT with battery-free Bluetooth.
Welcome to the Mr. Beacon Podcast. This week, I have the pleasure of interviewing Bob Proctor, who is the CEO of Link Labs, and we're going to be talking about scaling indoor location systems, IoT systems. So, Bob, welcome to the podcast.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you, Steve.
I have admired your company for some time, and I think for a number of reasons, you've combined some really excellent technical brains with, I think, some very deft management and strategy and focus. And I'd like you to introduce Link Labs in a moment, but I think where I'd like to focus the discussion is all of the things that go into scaling these solutions that we talk about so much on this podcast, which is we talk a lot about real-time location systems and IoT and so forth. And I think a lot of companies have started and failed, but I think some of the ones that have been very successful have been able to build a full stack solution that really does scale. So I want to drill into that. But maybe we should start off with you introducing people to Link Labs. Let's start there.
Yeah, wonderful. Link Labs is a end-to-end solution provider for asset tracking and monitoring. And our really mission is to make it easy and affordable to track and monitor anything anywhere. And those adjectives are chosen purposefully. We want to make it easy. It's got to be easy to use. Everyone today expects a consumer product like Experience just works out of the box, highly interoperable with third-party technologies. But in my view, IoT is about affordability. All these assets that people want to track and monitor are largely fielded today. It's a question of why are they not tracked or monitored? Mostly it's about cost and bringing the cost down enough to drive ROI. So we really focus on those two things from an end-to-end perspective.
Very good. And if you were to, when you sell a solution to customers, what are you selling them? What are the core building blocks of that solution?
Whew, there's a lot that goes into it. So there's the solution itself, and oftentimes that involves everything from tags and sensors through to a local network that could be an LPWAN network layer or a BLE mesh technology or something that delivers through, you know, directly to cellular. There can be an aggregation layer through the cellular networks. We typically use the what I call purpose-built IoT network layer technologies, you know, Cat-M and NB-IoT, through to cloud platforms and device management, and on to user interface, which might include workflows and those types of things. That would be the core product piece of what we have to deliver. But in addition, you have to deliver the everything that wraps around that product to make it scalable. Mm-hmm. Supply chain and operations on getting hardware into the US typically, if it's sourced out of outside of the U.S. You know, for most of our scaling has happened here. Working with a 3PL to kit it for specific facilities, making sure it gets delivered, handling returns. So there's a lot on just on the operations side. Mm-hmm. And there's, you know, financial aspects that tie to all of that, and financial integrations that need to happen. Then you have field installation, training, certifications, auditing, monitoring, tools, you know, phone-based tools, web-based tools, that kind of thing. For field operations, then you've got to build a kind of a support capability for fielded product, and there's everything that goes into that. And then you also have to have, you know, the more traditional DevOps and support for monitoring actual management. So there's a lot that wraps around the actual product.
And how far up the stack do you go? So tags, infrastructure, connectivity, support. What about in the application layer?
We go end to end. Our application layer is very sophisticated. We really use all the state-of-the-art tools from you know, basic tables and reports and maps. But you know, the mapping now has gotten quite sophisticated. We integrate with, you know, third parties where we can do seamless indoor-outdoor mapping. So you could take a what you might typically view as a map that you would zoom in on. You can zoom in on a facility, you can zoom into the floor plans within that facility, and you can find assets inside specific rooms or your office. But I can also track that, you know, leaving your facility over the road into a distribution center, through that distribution center, over the road again to, say, an end customer. So seamless indoor-outdoor tracking. Types of capabilities connected into all the search, sort, tabulation, AI type tools, kits that are available as well. It's a pretty, a lot of work has gone into that.
And you guys have been known as pioneers in using all sorts of radio technologies. So I think there's some companies that do what you just described, and they don't have RF experts. They don't have people that are kind of building things from the ground up. But you do. You did some of the pioneering work in with LoRa, the long range wide area technology, low power. Is that necessary? Why go to the trouble of assembling a team that can go that deep rather than just kind of using off-the-shelf building blocks?
That's a great question. I mean, some of it is where we started, but I think if we were to start anew, I would go there. Mm-hmm. You know, we started as an LPWAN network layer technology with the first certified LoRa products in the U.S. And then as the carriers entered with Cat-M, we partnered and had the first certified Cat-M products. But what we learned through that is, if you think about, again, affordability of an IoT solution, this is where our partnership with Wiliot, you know, really makes a lot of sense too. Anything times millions of tags starts to drive the ROI model. You know, multiply any number times, you know, millions, and you're like, oh, I got to worry about the cost. And really that cost is not just the cost of the tag, it's the total cost of ownership over the lifetime of that tag. And that very quickly takes you into, for anything that's battery powered, either, you know, with a tag or through some of the intermediate layers, what's the battery life of that device? Mm-hmm. Because the battery replacement cycle drives cost tremendously. And then also, what is the data related costs for transport of that data? And I like to point out that the data costs of IoT are extraordinarily high. You know, a megabyte on a Cat-M plan might be, you know, order of magnitude $1 a month. Well, your consumer cell phone is probably, you know, for that same plan, about a penny a month. IoT has this golden coffee stirrer straw, you know, size data pipe. It's very expensive and very narrow. So you really have to be worried about data efficiency as well as battery and power consumption efficiency. All that is resting in the wireless network layer technologies. So you've got to be really smart in those areas in order to drive down cost, which again opens up the promise of IoT and makes it real.
What are you seeing in terms of your own business about the backhaul? Is it going over wired or wireless networks? You were talking about the cost of NB-IoT.
Yeah, for us, it's predominantly wireless because we're looking at where the big volumes and a lot of the promise in IoT are supply chain logistics, shipping, transport, those types of things, where the goods and the containers that ship those goods are all moving, mm-hmm. and they're moving through a very fragmented supplier distribution chain, where you don't really have the luxury of installing any kind of infrastructure. So you've got to have your network layer technologies essentially moving with the assets.
Mm-hmm. So you're putting gateway devices, for use of a better term, into vehicles, but also into static. Let me ask that question. Then I want to ask kind of about later on in the life of the product. Are you putting your devices into vehicles?
We're not in the kind of traditional ODGB port vehicle fleet telematics space. We're more, you know, we think of it as, you know, trucking is wildly fragmented and, you know, you really want to be on the pallet that has the goods on it. So I think of more as a pallet or a tote or a crate becomes a IoT platform, a mobile IoT platform. And if you can have a mobile gateway that lasts 5-10 years integrated into that, now you can have low cost tags and items at the package level riding on top of that. So that's where, you know, again, I think our partnership holds tremendous commercial potential.
And what about when you get to the destination, if it's a store or a hotel or wherever the location is, are your devices running over Wi-Fi or are they using cellular connections there?
Yeah, our devices are meant to essentially take advantage of the most power efficient and low cost available backhaul capability. So, for example, if you have a facility you own, you can establish a LPWAN network layer and the devices will backhaul through that, typically connecting via Bluetooth. If there's a local Bluetooth enabled, what we call in our terminology, an access point. And then that access point can backhaul via any type of network technologies to the cloud. And that's more power efficient than if that's not available and you're in a third party site where you don't have an opportunity to put in infrastructure, then it'll backhaul through the cellular, onboard cellular capability.
But why not just have every device go onto the Wi-Fi?
That's a possibility. We tend to not see that in the market because, again, you've got a highly fragmented supply or distribution chain, and those Wi-Fi networks all have different, you know, security and credentialing associated with them. And you, as the provider of a capability, it just takes somebody in that chain to change the password or credentialing, and your whole system stops functioning. And so, you know, reliance on compliance of third party, you know, many third party IT departments, just not a good kind of reliable solution. Okay. So, you know, we'd like to say, look, you know, you don't want to be relying on that Wi-Fi capability. And also, you know, Wi-Fi is expensive to put in areas where it doesn't exist. You know, a lot of warehouses might have it in the corner near the warehouse manager's office, but it will not be ubiquitous throughout a warehouse or a factory floor, in which case you do need to establish a network layer. And beyond Wi-Fi, what we've also found is cellular coverage is really designed for people with phones that can move to an area where there is good coverage. You know, how many times have you walked outside a building to get a good signal? Mm-hmm. You know, things don't do that. You know, the forklift driver puts it in the corner of the warehouse, and if there's no coverage there, there's no coverage there. So you need a very cost-effective and easily deployable way to augment coverage as well. And that's where the LPWAN technologies do fit in really nicely into an overall solution architecture.
So it's really, it's quite a sophisticated cocktail of radio technologies that you're bringing together. It's the theme of our discussion is achieving scalability, and it's kind of interesting how sophisticated you need to get in order to do something simple, which is to help to cover a huge chain of hotels or whatever.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, it's taken us a long time. We've been at this for 5 or 6 years, right? And, we've had to solve these problems in order to scale some of our customers.
And what stage have you got to in scaling your customers? Where are you seeing success?
Yeah, our biggest success has been in the hospitality industry. Certainly, that's on, for all practical purposes, on pause with COVID. And that was really because there have been, if you're in a sales world, you call it an urgency driver, but really compliance drivers in that market. Many state and local governments mandated a housekeeper safety solution, essentially for housekeepers and hotels, where they could essentially have our solution has a pendant, they can squeeze a pendant. You have to identify the specific room they're in and be able to notify security. And it has to not reside on the Wi-Fi network because it's just not reliable enough across a footprint of 1,000 hotels. So we scale that solution to several hundred 100,000 plus hotel rooms, not quite at a couple hundred thousand yet. And ultimately, I think that'll end up in close to 1 million hotel rooms. We're certainly contracted to get there.
That's very significant scale. And I think, as we're focusing on scale, it seems like one of the things you need is a compelling event. And legislation is one. And I've seen other companies that have been using this safety of staff members as a driver to get some success. I remember in the early days when I was going on a lot of sales training courses, there were all sorts of acronyms to remind business people on how to qualify given an opportunity. And one of my favorites was Scotsman, which basically stands for, do you have a solution to an important problem? Who's the competition? Do you know what the other alternatives are? Is it original? Are you differentiated? And the T in Scotsman was time. And time was basically, do you understand the timescales of this project? But is there a compelling event why it needs to be done this month, this year? And I think legislation is clearly one of them. Are there any other, and just because people are going to wonder what the rest of Scotsman is. size, is it big enough? Money, does the person have a budget? A is access to the decision maker, and N is kind of a compelling need with an ROI that's associated with it. But going back to the T in Scotsman, what are the other drivers that you're seeing that are actually driving people to spend money on IoT?
Let me talk about hospitality, but I want to come back to sort of where we think our focus more broadly, or the larger commercial opportunity, impact opportunities. But in hospitality, there's a couple other ones. This is really about employee safety. Obviously, the unions are behind it, and that's become part of collective bargaining agreements as well. Mm-hmm. So there's an urgency driver around that as well, and compliance with those agreements. Then finally, it becomes part of the brand promise. You just can't be a large employer looking to recruit and say that you don't care about your people, right? So it's we're going to deploy this capability because it's part of our human resources brand promise in the employment market. Those three combined really create an enormous urgency driver to say, we're going to implement this in all hotels by the end of this year, full stop, which has been great. In the hospitality. In the other areas, I continue to be astounded by the sheer dollars and cents and hard dollar ROI that is available from asset tracking and monitoring, and just how much low hanging fruit there still is. You take something, one of my favorite examples is sort of, take something like, beer kegs, just to pick on a random vertical. And you say, well, how much money is there in tracking and monitoring beer kegs? Where's the value created? Well, there's obviously lost and not recovered steel, but that's really just the beginning. There's out of stock situations at bars and restaurants where your product is just not being served. That's lost sales. There is delivery route optimization to, get the right beer to the right places. There is brand compliance. What if this stuff sits on a dock shelf or something, gets hot, gets served? That's impacting your brand. There is understanding demand and production planning and doing a better job actually forecasting demand, because there's no real-time demand signal now, back into from a production perspective. So as you get deeper and deeper into it, you're like, there are many drivers of ROI here, all basically enabled by the data of where is it and did the temperature go out of bounds? And we see that over and over again in the supply chain logistics space.
I'm interested in, I find these examples of ROI fascinating, because you end up learning, you peel up the layers of the onion and you get under the covers of these businesses and you realize, it's very exciting when you can have that sort of conversation, and you also can have conversations about multipathing of radio waves and signal propagation. There's a lot. You have to be kind of a bit of a Renaissance man to cover all that. How do you, tell me a bit about how you end up having the kind of conversations that lead you to understand those ROIs. It seems like it might be challenging to span the technical and the business.
Yeah, I guess that I set out my career-wise to sort of span the technical and the business, right? With a technical background going into a long training arc of maybe 20 years in the business world, really not doing things something with technology. Yeah. I think from a customer perspective, it starts usually with only one aspect of the ROI. It could be simply, I've seen it from a loss and recovery perspective. Glass shipping racks have been treated, there might be anywhere between $1,000 and $3,000 for a rack for industrial glass. Think about the, the big panes of glass you see in office buildings, like, the one behind you. Those things are shipped on racks, and the racking itself is quite expensive. And in many ways, they have, up until now, been in some ways thought of like paper clips that are $1,000 each. You look to recover them, but you don't recover all of them. And you see companies losing, millions, if not tens of millions of dollars on lost racking. And so the person who's in charge of that might start there. But then you quickly realize, well, customer support is really interested in understanding where the glass that didn't go somewhere was supposed to go, or you end up talking to the production people saying, we need a particular SKU of racking, or we can't actually run production today because we didn't recover enough racks to have anywhere to put the glass that we're manufacturing. So we see typically one pain point being the cause for initiation of a conversation, and then it broadens to many more over time.
And when you go in to these accounts, you basically stop when you find one that's big enough to drive a project. How do you manage scope? Because it must be tempting to where do you stop in terms of the on one hand, you want the biggest ROI as possible, so scope gets very big. On the other hand, you want something that's achievable, the quick win thing. How have you managed that in achieving scale? Because true scale requires breadth, but it also requires progress,
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think, you know, I'm probably overly influenced from my consulting days of our approach really is what we call a journey partner. And we really need to work with the customer as a partner, an extension of their team, to understand, you know, just the reality of their situation and stage gate any work we do with them around, look, you know, we need to start by building trust with you. Let's do something small that delivers impact, you know, shows you what we can do. After that, you know, you need to start to think about building the ROI case and gathering the data to prove ROI. And so we look to get to a scope or scale that says, you know, let's, you know, now you know that we can do what we say we can do, let's show that we can actually deliver value in a reasonable way. So it's a way of, you know, I think the way we think about it is from a customer's perspective, they're looking to manage their risk. And they manage that through a series of project stages. And so we try not to go in with, hey, here's 10 ways you can save money in the ROI case and you need to go straight to a million assets right away. We tend to go in with, let's understand your appetite for risk and the strategic importance of this to your business. And then we'll appropriately stage gate and scope a project to kind of fit in your kind of risk profile.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Good. And I mean, that potentially is taking a long time. And I always end up going back to Geoffrey Moore and crossing the chasm and the kind of the bowling pin metaphor where you start off with one and then, you know, and you're, as you cross the chasm, then things get faster. Where are we if we're crossing the chasm and the chasm is in IoT adoption? Mm-hmm. And in my mind, I nirvana is we connect everything to the internet. If you know where everything is, then suddenly costs go down, sales go up. Capital is more efficiently used. Have we crossed the chasm? Are we in the middle of it? Where do you think we are?
I think we are a toehold on the other side.
Okay.
You know, the promise of all the various components of this technology, you know, they're all kind of beyond Gen 1 now. You know, there's a lot of hype. And then you get to Gen 1, and that kind of delivers on the hype, but it's expensive and it's missing some features and capabilities and it doesn't connect with third-party things. And you can you spend a lot of time solving a lot of problems saying, hey, you know, in order to really deliver on the promise, we got to get to Gen 2 or Gen 3. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we have now, you know, stitched together in many instances Gen 2 or Gen 3 of the various aspects of a solution. And I'm to the point where I'm like, this is pretty powerful. And it's working, you know, more and more out of the box with massive scalability and a very, you know, reasonable price point. And we're starting to see also, I think, more broad-based market demand. You know, this is becoming a strategic initiative for many more companies. So I think we're, you know, I look at it from a technology perspective and believe that we're basically there. I think from a market perspective, the state of maturity of the technology is not fully appreciated yet.
Right. So I guess one way of calibrating this is, who are you selling to typically? If you were wrong and we're still firmly on the other side of the chasm, then you'd be selling to innovators and early adopters, quirky mavericks who are trying to do something because it's different and have a strategic advantage because no one else is doing what they're doing. And if we've really crossed the chasm, then you'll be selling to the early majority. And maybe who's buying your technology?
I think of it from a ROI perspective, and you can kind of back that into a intrinsic value of the asset perspective. So for example, I often talk about, if you had a $100,000, piece of art or pallet of vaccines, that's probably already tracked, right? You stick a motorcycle battery and a cell phone and you figure out how to track that thing because it's so valuable. You get down to a $10,000, high-end computer server, where you get lower down to a piece of leased medical equipment at, the intrinsic value is, $1,000 to $5,000, these glass shipping racks, powered wheelchairs we see. So you get into asset values that are, call it, in the plus or minus $1,000 range. There, the ROI for tracking, monitoring these things is really high because the asset value is really quite high. You get down to beer kegs, we're not there yet, because you still got to get farther down the cost curve to really make that.
How much does a beer keg cost approximately?
I think it's between $50 and $100 of steel.
Okay. Yeah.
So you've got you've got a ways to go to get down the curve, but there are a lot more. There may be, I'm trying to think off the top of my head, hundreds of thousands of glass shipping racks. There are hundreds of millions of beer kegs, and there are billions of wooden pallets, right? So it's all about getting down the cost curve to make the ROI work. So what we're seeing is we're coming down into that kind of sub-$1,000 range pretty nicely now. Mm-hmm. And where you're just seeing, hey, I'm looking for a solution. What do you have? We now have the ability to, help people stand up a demonstration capability and with an out-of-the-box experience that, we're looking to deliver in under 60 seconds. People are like, this is great. I want to deploy it. You get into, if I was going to be working in the, we don't have any even inquiries in the beer keg world. So it's funny I use that as an example, but I think we'll move there. We should talk about that. Yeah, and the reason we don't is because we need to do more with your tags. So. Right? It is the cost of the tag, right, to make that. Yeah. That business case, but the volumes there are huge.
Yeah.
And, to our point, we've just started working together as we get this integration, nailed down and have, again, it's the wrapper, the supply chain, the operations. I'm sure you've spent a lot of time working on how do you make these things, with Avery printable and mm-hmm. Mass volumes and getting to your second generation of technology. But we're kind of there, right? I mean, it's, the technology is kind of there. And so I think we'll see more and more, significant scale trials and pilots in these lower cost assets. And so, but we're kind of crossing the chasm by asset value, if you will, and we're seeing the higher price assets. We've sort of crossed the chasm, the really low cost assets. We're on our way there, but we're not there yet.
Yeah, we debate about tracking. Some of us feel like we should be tracking bottles of beer. Others of us think we need to be tracking bottles of spirits.
Right, exactly. It's just a question of how much can you drive down the cost curve to make it effective for the
client. Who in the organization are you normally selling to? Are you selling to innovation teams or an operations manager that's got a problem that your technology can fix?
It's both. Great question, but it's both. We see, again, with the more kind of early majority client space, that's more operations folks and more the innovation teams when they're looking at broad corporate transformation.
Yeah, very good. And so how big is your company?
We're about 40 people today, and we're growing like crazy. So,
So how does a company? There's only so fast you can grow that company. How are you looking to scale up in terms of your go-to-market?
We do most of our go-to-market through partners. You know, and frankly, you know, what we found is technology partners have developed a component of an end-to-end solution at various levels. And it's everything from, you know, Bluetooth chip and cellular modem providers to hardware providers to network layer technology providers, you know, the tag ecosystem providers, device management, mapping companies. There are a lot of great components of the solution that have built customer relationships and demand. And the vast majority of demand in the market is asset tracking and monitoring. Mm-hmm. So by being interoperable with that broad ecosystem of technology partners, the first thing we're doing is really partnering with them on their go-to-market and picking up a lot of the customers that they've developed to, you know, various stages. We also have channel partnerships, you know, with big players on the SI side. Our deepest relationship is with AT&T. And there are times, you know, I think of it as, you know, those are best utilized when there's also value add from the channel partner, either through field operations, you know, as we've scaled the hospitality industry, their ability to have feet on the ground in, you know, hundreds of hotels, you know, 2 weeks later, like, you know, across the entire U.S., you know, really strong relationships, ability to manage that, you know, security related services we don't provide if things escalate outside of, you know, kind of the core technology into a managed service, you know, those types of things. So what we find the most challenging from a partnership, and we've kind of done a few, and then, you know, it's always tricky to find the right opportunity, or on the pure systems integrator that we're in some ways as an end-to-end solution provider, we compete with, and the margin stacking takes you down a road of, well, we just made this solution no longer cost effective because, you know, somebody's basically not really adding a valuable service. They're just a straight channel partner. So we found that from a go-to-market perspective, you know, working with our technology partners is you know, been the easiest and the best, followed by when a partner like an AT&T has a value-added capability that the client also needs.
There are other providers, vendors, it's a horrible name, vendor, but we're vendors, who have been very successful working with the systems integrators, the Accentures, the Deloittes, and so forth. Yeah, SAP comes to mind, going way back, Lotus Notes. Those companies had like huge boons working with them. What you say makes sense. You provide an end-to-end solution. So having someone charge $1 million to figure out, you know, what the solution should look like when you've already got something, it kind of, it's a waste of money, isn't it? So maybe your problem is that your solution is too good. If it needed a huge amount of tailoring and wasn't so complete, there would be a role for the systems integrators. How do you account for that? You know, why not you and those other technology providers?
Well, I think, you know, we can make it work as you know, I think we have made it work, but it's back to, I like to think of them as a systems integrator really has a value add, and you have to ask the question, what is the value add, so that you can get the economics to work. You know, if I go back to, you know, my enterprise software days 20 years ago, you know, the systems integrators I used to think about was predominantly driven by there was so much implementation work for integration that you couldn't scale your labor nearly fast enough as a enterprise software company. So you had to work through a systems integrator that was really doing a lot of the implementation services related work.
Yes.
As the value add. But as you start to bring that implementation services down to, you know, ideally, you know, close to zero, there's less and less work for them in the overall context of the solution.
Right.
And that's, you know, to me, the goal of IoT. And one of the things that's really nice about asset tracking is, you know, in the oversimplified sense, you slap a tag on something and you're done with the, and then I'm giving you a report and the analytics and, you know, with the APIs and the cloud infrastructure, you know, connecting these systems together with microservices today is, a much simpler task than it was, you know, years ago. It's a question of, you know, where's the value add? And that's where I go to, you know, field services, along with, ongoing monitoring, managed services, or, you know, getting into some of the uniqueness of verticals, or integration, we don't, for example, integrate into all the different trucking companies to set up shipping lanes for returnable assets, right? But we provide the data flow and an SI can play in there. So it's just a question of, as we mature a little bit, developing those partnerships where it's where the core technology, the solution isn't marked up, but instead, you know, ancillary services are sold and that's how they make their money.
That makes a ton of sense. What about analytics partners? Because one of the things about IoT is you're suddenly creating all this data that didn't exist. Or does your solution provide the actionable results in a way that doesn't require a lot of analytics? And do you see synergies there?
Yes. We have a lot of the analytic capabilities ourselves as well, straight up through the AI capabilities. And so, again, it's an interesting question, sort of analytics on what. We've actually built our platform to ingest any source of third-party data to provide those analytics. And, you know, most of the tools from, you know, as an example, Google, for example, and their search capabilities and their AI capabilities have all been sort of open sourced and are leverageable into, a backend platform. And so we've integrated all of that capability. I find that we can go pretty far with what we've got. We like to do an exercise with our customers, which we just call a magic wand. Let's sit at the board, and if you could magic wand your ideal report or your ideal alert, and who would be told what when what happens, you know, and have a working session with a magic wand, usually it's less than a day to actually turn that into real reports, real alerts, and capabilities, which is a lot of fun. And we can deliver custom reports and workflow capabilities now through our UI to an end customer in very short turnaround. So what used to take months back in the day when we were, you know, if you were building like enterprise software, is now, you know, an hours long task. So the speed to create that is just amazing.
That's very cool. Very cool. Well, unfortunately, we're running out of time. I there's a ton of stuff I'd like to talk to you about. Your Link Labs is doing some amazing work back, if we go back down the stack, on in terms of really precise location using Bluetooth technology. So let's resolve to get back together again and talk about that. But in the meantime, Bob, thanks very much for telling us a bit about how you've managed to scale Link Labs. And I think there's a lot of really interesting lessons learned for other people watching. So.
Well, thank you, Steve. Yeah, and I would welcome the opportunity to talk about what we're doing on the Bluetooth location side. That's a whole nother topic, so that'd be great. Appreciate it.
I noticed you have a PhD in applied physics.
That's correct.
What's the application that you ended up studying? What was your?
I ended up working in ultrafast lasers. Actually, worked in designed and built at the time a laser that set the world record for the shortest pulse of light directly generated from a laser.
How do you shorten? What does it take to shorten a pulse of a laser beam?
It takes non-linearities in the behavior of the media that you're doing. So basically the electric field, as the pulse gets shorter and shorter, the electric field gets higher and higher, and that starts to alter the index of refraction of the material. And so you can get a reinforcing effect that can lead to a very short pulse of light. It's pretty cool stuff.
And how did you get from doing that to McKinsey? Is that where you
were? Yeah, it's a great question. I read about a guy who helped invent the thing called the soliton in fiber optic communications at Bell Labs, which kept the need for batteries to be used as repeaters and undersea fiber optic cables. Essentially allows the pulses to not disperse through fiber over 10,000 kilometers or more of fiber. And I learned how much money he made versus what the CEO made and said, maybe I want to be on the business side of this equation. And McKinsey was a great way to do it. They had a new program for taking PhDs and turning them into business people. And I signed up for that and was off in the business world.
And how did you get to Link Labs from that? I imagine it's a fairly sort of long path, but
For me, I'd always been at the intersection of technology and business, and always been very entrepreneurial. So really focused my career on starting and growing companies and gaining experience at large companies, which I certainly got with McKinsey, and intermediate scale companies with the corporate executive board, a couple hundred million in revenue, but very entrepreneurial, and was fortunate enough to do pretty well with a couple of early stage companies, and became a full-time angel investor and advisor in 2008. And I started looking for opportunities at the very beginning, centered around what I called a critical mass of world-class talent. The belief being, if you can get a critical mass of world-class talent together, you can figure out the product, the strategy, I brought a lot of marketing from my experience sort of post-McKinsey, early stage finance was what I was in the middle of, and start to build a company. So I looked for groups of people looking to start companies that had deep technical competence, and started to focus my investment activities there. Link Labs is one of those companies. And then about 2 years later, the technical team said, "Hey, we need a CEO." And I was basically about 7 or 8 years out of a corporate job and said, okay, I'll do one more run. So here I am. And I love it too, actually.
Yeah, I've worked at, I think Williot is kind of similar to that. The founders are like super, super smart engineers and basically surrounded themselves by other engineers. I think almost everyone in the company with there's like three exceptions out of 50 people has got some kind of engineering degree. And I worked at another company for many years that was an amazing company. And they were founded basically based on the people. And then they started looking around for something to do together and ended up developing the world's first symmetric multiprocessor computer that was used for commercial applications and eventually got bought by IBM. But the start was about the people.
Yeah. So, you see that over and over again. So that was basically the core of my investment thesis and the foundation of Link Labs. So,
Well, I traditionally ask our guests about their musical tastes for no particularly good reason, but do you enjoy music or?
I do. Given my age, I'm more of a classic rock kind of guy. I certainly listen to much newer music, a lot of it. But if I had to pick three songs to take to Mars, they would be definitely in the classic rock genre.
All right. And what did you choose?
It's funny. I had a hard time choosing because there's so many. but I would probably pick from Boston, More Than a Feeling.
Okay.
A little bit of Fleetwood Mac. Probably, gosh, what would I pick out of a Fleetwood Mac? I'll come back to that one in a second.
Okay. All right.
And then Dire Straits, maybe Sultans of Swing, or I was listening to Spirit of Radio. I don't know if you ever had that on your podcast or not, from Rush.
No.
Oh, there's a lyric in there about invisible airwaves crackling with life, you know, and of course, in the IoT space.
That's a great choice.
I thought, you know, maybe that's got to be part of part of what you take with you.
Yeah. Well, occasionally when good things happen, which they seem to happen fairly regularly where we work, we celebrate by people get a choice of buying some vinyl, because we've got a vinyl record player here at the office. And someone chose Dire Straits, and I've really been enjoying it.
Yeah. Boston's first album is probably what my favorite sort of album from growing up.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, thanks for that.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. No matter what you do or what industry you're in, how you communicate is key. Everything you type is equally important to collaboration, and Grammarly can help. Think of it as your AI writing partner, empowering you to communicate effectively and efficiently so you can make a bigger impact in the workplace. 96% of Grammarly users say it helps them craft more impactful writing. And as the gold standard of responsible AI, Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. By understanding your writing in context, Grammarly provides relevant, personalized suggestions. And with tone suggestions, you can navigate even the most difficult work conversations. You can also save time from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds with one click. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.